content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 27th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. GOP defends Trump against new revelations. What happened? The Republican Party began reluctantly coalescing around Donald Trump as its presumptive nominee this week, despite a slew of unflattering stories about the businessman's past behavior. The Washington Post revealed that Trump used to masquerade as his own publicist, using pseudonyms John Miller and John Barron to feed reporters stories and quotes about his sexual and business prowess. In an audio recording of a 1991 phone call, Miller, who sounds uncannily like Trump, told a reporter that the businessman was fending off attention from Madonna and other women and doing tremendously well financially. Trump last week flatly denied that it was his voice, even though he's previously admitted twice that he sometimes posed as a spokesman named Miller and Barron. 2 days later, the New York Times published an in-depth report on the presumptive nominee's treatment of women, outlining a history of unwelcome romantic advances, unending commentary on the female form, and unsettling workplace conduct. Trump, who also came under fire for refusing to release his tax returns, blasted the piece as false, malicious, and libelous. Last week's much-anticipated meeting between Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan didn't lead to an endorsement by the conservative Republican leader, but the two men expressed confidence that they could eventually unify our party. Trump and the Republican National Committee later agreed on a fundraising deal that will make it easier to share campaign funds, while the committee's chairman, Rince Priebus, urged all Republicans to rally around Trump to defeat Hillary Clinton. "People just don't care about his past behavior," Priebus said. "I think people are judging Donald Trump as to whether or not he's someone that's going to go to Washington and shake things up." What the editorial said. "The GOP's surrender to Trumpism is a terrible mistake," said the New York Times. "For years, Republicans have focused solely on winning elections, issuing coded appeals to nativists and racists in the base, while abandoning the party's most desperate voters. That approach has now come back to bite them. Yet rather than making a stand against Republican voices of intolerance and obstruction, the party's leaders are looking to rationalize their way to supporting a dangerous demagogue. The liberal tears are of the crocodile genus," said the Wall Street Journal. "Left-leaning politicians and pundits are secretly elated Trump will be the GOP's nominee, as he might enable the Democrats to retake the House and Senate. That's why Ryan was right to make nice with the Donald. Maintaining Republican control of the House could well be the last defense against Hillary Clinton's worst economic proposals, and avoiding a massive fallout with Trump may be the only way to protect it." What the columnist said. "The John Miller story tells us a lot about the man who would be the leader of the free world," said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. "Trump's pathetic posing as his own spokesman, so he could boast that women were lining up to jump in his bed, reveals his overwhelming insecurity. Combine his ego problem with his pathological lying and inability to control his rage, and you've got a guy with severe emotional issues. Nonetheless, media attacks on Trump probably won't do much damage," said S.E. Cupp in the New York Daily News. "He's proved he can deflect criticism by blaming the evil media, and the Times story on his sexism gave Trump the perfect opening to turn the spotlight back on Hillary Clinton's alleged enabling of husband Bill's own unsavory history with women." Trump has proved he's morally and intellectually unfit for the presidency, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. But by trying to minimize his odious behavior, GOP leaders are essentially confirming the destructive stereotype of Republicans as immigrant-bashing, women-hating bigots. That isn't what conservatism is about. By loyally lining up behind Trump, conservatives are surrendering their identity. Pundits love talking about the death of conservatism, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. But this always happens when there's a political earthquake. People confidently predict that things will never be the same again, only to be disproved the very next election cycle. Will Trump's agenda permanently displace the ideas that have formed the backbone of the conservative movement for generations? Not likely. The mood will change again. And a second main story. Democratic race takes a bitter turn. What happened? A deepening rift threatened Democratic Party unity in the general election this week as Hillary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders split primaries in Kentucky and Oregon. And Sanders and his supporters charged that the party has cheated them out of delegates and favored Clinton in the bruising race. In the bluegrass state, Clinton eked out a half-point victory with nearly 47% of the vote. Sanders won 56-44 in Oregon. By nearly splitting the day's delegate haul with Sanders, Clinton came within just 92 delegates of the total needed for the nomination, including superdelegates pledged to her. Sanders vowed to fight until the last ballot is cast, insisting he'd be the stronger candidate in November. The frustration of Sanders supporters boiled over at Nevada's Democratic Party convention last week. Arguing that delegate allocation rules had been rigged against them, some of the Vermont senators' backers threw chairs and shouted down speakers. Nevada's Democratic chairwoman was barraged with threatening phone messages, including one suggesting she should be hung. Pressured to respond, Sanders condemned any acts of violence and harassment, but warned that Americans are outraged at the political establishment. The infighting may be taking a toll. In a new NBC News poll, Clinton led presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump by only 48% to 45%. What the columnist said. Sanders had a chance to show real leadership over the Nevada near riot, but he blew it, said Matthew Cooper in Newsweek.com. Instead, he buried a rather limp plea for nonviolence in a rant over what he considered unfair treatment by the party, ignoring the fact that Clinton received more delegates in Nevada because she won 53% of the vote there. Sanders has launched an important idealistic American political movement, but he should be judged partly by how he deals with his worst supporters. So far, the passionate Vermont senator has been pure milquetoast. Sanders could become 2016's Ralph Nader, said Bill Sharon, Politico.com. In 2000, Nader's 97,488 votes in pivotal Florida probably cost Al Gore the presidency. Sanders has pledged that he won't run as a third-party spoiler and will support Clinton if she's nominated. But if he keeps delegitimizing Clinton in the eyes of the left, or fails to offer a strong endorsement when she finally wins the nomination, the senator could drive his young, energized supporters toward the Green Party's Jill Stein or the Libertarian Party's Gary Johnson. That would be quite a gift for Donald Trump. Does Sanders even care? Asked Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. After all, running for president is addictive, especially for a congressional backbencher who labored in relative obscurity for two decades. Now the longtime independent basks in media attention and the adulation of huge crowds. This is probably the most fun that Sanders has ever had in his life. But addicts tend to make self-destructive choices that also harm those around them. In Sanders' case, inflicting potentially lasting damage to the cohesion of his adopted party. Our controversy of the week, bathroom wars. Has Obama gone too far? You may not have realized it yet, said David French in NationalReview.com, but the Obama administration just destroyed the traditional American public school. In typical imperial fashion, President Obama last week had his flunkies at the Department of Justice and the Department of Education send a letter to every school district in the country warning them that students who claim to be transgender must now legally be treated as members of the gender they identify with. That means boys who say they're girls can now play on girls' sports teams, room with girls on field trips, and have access to girls' locker rooms and bathrooms. We all remember Obama's promise to fundamentally transform America, said Cal Thomas in FoxNews.com. But who knew he had in mind a nation where girls would be forced to share bathrooms with boys? What happened to the right to privacy, so revered by the progressive left? What happened to conservatives' reverence for individual freedom, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. The administration's letter to schools, a directive clarifying the legal issue, not an order, essentially advises them to leave transgender students alone and let them live in peace. Conservatives started this fight by trying to demonize trans people, even kids, as witnessed by a new North Carolina law that bans transgender people from using the restroom corresponding to their gender identity. Conservatives are still bitter about the legalization of gay marriage and are whipping up fear of boys in girls' rooms as a new way to protect their rigid notion of gender essentialism. The suicide rate among transgender people, especially the young, is absurdly high because of the rejection they constantly face, said Rex Hupke in the Chicago Tribune. I'm sorry, but those lives are worth far more to me than anyone's squirmy, unmoored from reality washroom fears. Restrooms are bad enough, but putting boys in girls' locker rooms and showers is crazy, said Joy Pullman in TheFederalist.com. Several stories have already emerged of men showing up in women's locker rooms, saying they had the right to be there. I would frankly move to Australia, quit my job, and live on rice casseroles to keep my daughter from having to shower next to a naked, penis-bodied being. By saying that transgender people are in the wrong bathroom makes them feel unsafe, said Michelle Goldberg in Slate.com. Anti-trans conservatives have cleverly appropriated one of the left's favorite rationales. If college students have a right to be absolutely safe from images or ideas that make them uncomfortable, how can liberals insist that girls and women should have to share shower and restroom facilities with biological males, even if they don't want to? Aren't girls who fear male predators in dresses, or who simply don't want to pee or undress around people born male, entitled to a safe space too? In real-world schools that already support trans students, said the Charlotte Observer in an editorial, everyone's safety and privacy needs are being met. Some schools are offering alternative unisex restrooms. In Kentucky, one district set up private changing areas shielded by curtains for any student who wanted one. We must remember that every civil rights struggle has involved overcoming discomfort, with blacks sharing facilities, with gays sharing marriage. Later, we realized that it was not nearly so awful as some people imagined. It's no surprise that this issue would provoke such strong emotion, said Nick Haslam in the Washington Post. Bathrooms are places where private behavior becomes shared, where people feel uniquely vulnerable and anxious. It may seem ludicrous to turn these quiet, tiled rooms into social and political battlefields, but Freud would not have been at all surprised. It was a good week for raising revenue after a British barber launched a campaign to tax bushy hipster beards to help reduce the country's deficit, pointing to a similar law under King Henry VIII as precedent. The government should be cashing in, said barber Anthony Kent. It was a good week for the rule of law after a Florida police chief issued himself a parking ticket when a neighbor alerted him that his vehicle was parked illegally. I cannot hold anyone accountable until I hold myself accountable, Chief Melvin Tennyson said after paying the $45 fine. And it was a good week for parting shots after a Virginia woman's obituary listed the upcoming presidential election as her cause of death. Faced with the prospect of voting for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, the Richmond Times-Dispatch obit began, Marianne Nolan chose instead to pass into the eternal love of God. But it was a bad week for fighting fire with fire. After former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, a big Hillary Clinton supporter, said Donald Trump's comments about women will backfire because there are probably more ugly women in America than attractive women. And it was a bad week for attachments. After a 2-foot-long nurse shark chomped down on a 23-year-old female swimmer's arm in Boca Raton, causing her to be rushed to the hospital with a dead fish still attached. It's nothing we've ever had before, said a first responder. It was a bad week for failing to clear the cache after a conservative Virginia congressional candidate posted a screen grab of his computer screen that showed browser tabs to porn sites. Mike Webb explained that he was merely testing his theory that porn sites contain viruses. On the briefing page, rigging elections, the legal way. Political parties use gerrymandering to give themselves a big edge on election day. What is gerrymandering? It's a tactic used by political parties to redraw voting districts to give themselves an electoral advantage. Whether Republicans or Democrats control the process in a given state, the trick is to create irregularly shaped districts that segregate as many of the opposition supporters as possible into a small handful of seats, leaving their own candidates with a much better chance of winning everywhere else. To simplify, a state with 100,000 Democrats and 100,000 Republican voters in 6 districts, a GOP legislature would group 80,000 Democrats into 2 districts. That would leave just 20,000 Democrats spread over the other 4 districts, where the GOP could easily win. This process has left most states with oddly shaped districts, often with strips of land jutting out in several directions. It's perfectly legal, unless it can be proved that the districts are deliberately drawn to disenfranchise minorities, a practice outlawed by the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Is this a new strategy? No. The word gerrymander comes from a salamander-shaped district in Massachusetts, redrawn that way in 1812 by then-Governor Elbridge Gerry. But computerized voter registration rolls have made the practice far more sophisticated, widespread, and effective. In the 2012 election, Republicans won 1.4 million fewer votes than Democrats, but still secured a dominant 234-201 House majority. A frustrated President Obama raised the issue in his State of the Union address this year, calling for changes to a system that allowed politicians to pick their voters and not the other way around. Why are districts redrawn? The Constitution requires that state states use new census data to redraw their electoral maps every 10 years, so that each district has roughly the same number of voters. In all but six states where independent commissions draw the district lines, that process is run or overseen by whichever party controls the state legislature, with the governor able to veto redrawn maps. In the 2010 election cycle, the Republican Party took gerrymandering to a new level by creating a national redistricting strategy. The GOP's plan, which they called Red Map, was to keep or win Republican control of state legislatures with the largest impact on congressional redistricting. How successful was it? Overwhelmingly so. After pouring $30 million into state legislature races, a huge sum for down-ballot fights, the Republicans gained a record 680 state seats. That gave them total control of 25 state legislatures, which between them oversaw the redistricting process for 40% of congressional House of Representatives seats. Democrats were left with total redistricting control of just 10% of House seats. Neither party has complete control over the redistricting process for the other 50% of seats. Using sophisticated mapping software, Republican officials then redrew dozens of districts to their advantage. In 2012, these gerrymandered states helped the party protect its House majority. In Pennsylvania, House Republicans won 49% of the vote, but took 72% of the seats. 13 seats to the Democrats, 5. In Ohio, they took 12 seats to 4, with only 52% of the vote. What about the Democrats? In states they control, they gerrymander just as aggressively. Democratic-controlled Maryland is one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. A U.S. Circuit Court judge once likened its third congressional district to a broken-winged pterodactyl, lying prostrate across the center of the state. Illinois is another heavily gerrymandered blue state. Despite winning only 55% of the popular vote in 2012, Democratic House candidates captured 12 of the state's 18 seats. When President Obama was state senator in Chicago, he helped redraw his district to include some of the city's wealthiest and most liberal residents, deepening the support base he later used to win his U.S. Senate seat. But Republicans have definitely gerrymandered more effectively, partly because geography already tilts the system in their favor. In what way? Democratic voters tend to be concentrated in compact urban areas. That means that even in a state with no gerrymandering, there would likely be a handful of very safe Democratic seats, with the rest of the state consisting of a larger collection of Republican-leaning rural and suburban districts. For this reason, many Republicans insist the effects of gerrymandering are exaggerated. One data analyst ran electoral scenarios that offset the effects of gerrymandering in 2012. They found that the Republicans still would have retained control of the House, albeit with a much smaller majority. Is the system likely to change? Several states are looking at handing responsibility for redistricting to an independent, nonpartisan commission, which has already been done in California, Arizona, and Washington. Computer software could easily redistrict maps in the fairest way possible, so that each district is a standard geometric shape. But widespread change is unlikely. Politicians rarely relinquish their own power, and most attempts to overhaul the rules tend to result in lengthy court battles. For now and the foreseeable future, as GOP strategist and Red Map architect Karl Rove put it, he who controls redistricting can control Congress. Moving into the columns now, we'll take first one from the U.S. giving miners false hope about coal. Technological change has shattered the newspaper industry, costing thousands of people their jobs, said David Horsey. But neither I nor any of my journalist colleagues ever thought to ask a politician to save us, prop up a dying industry, and guarantee we'd not have to reinvent ourselves. Yet that's what coal miners are demanding of presidential candidates this year. Democrat Hillary Clinton recently enraged people connected to the coal industry in West Virginia by addressing a hard economic truth. Coal is in irreversible decline, losing its market to cheap, cleaner natural gas and renewables. She offered a $30 million plan to retrain miners for jobs in growing alternative energy sector, but they much preferred the pandering of presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump. He told miners that as president, he'll get rid of environmental regulations, their industry will thrive, and their jobs will come back. This is nonsensical. Coal is dirty, unhealthy, dangerous, and anachronistic, a prime driver of climate change, air pollution, and toxic mercury levels in fish. Coal miners need to reinvent themselves for the 21st century instead of wishing someone would roll back the clock to the 19th. From Sweden, don't allow Muslims to shun women. Sweden is struggling with its newfound multiculturalism, said Expressen. While Muslims make up only 4% of the population, their requests for accommodations are testing all of society. Politician Yasri Khan was forced to resign from the Green Party last month after he refused to shake hands with a female reporter. He bowed his head and placed his hand on his heart instead, saying the gesture was a respectful greeting. Some Swedish politicians supported him, but his Green colleagues were outraged. This month, Culture Minister Alice Bah Kuhnke refused a request from an Islamic group for segregated swimming times for Muslim girls at public pools. Again, Swedish leaders were divided on the issue, and the opinions don't break along clear lines like left versus right, or even Christian versus Muslim. All of us are wrestling with the question, which is more liberal, to give wider freedoms for different subcultures to live as they wish, or to assert a universal standard of rights for all? Ultimately, we need to find a balance. Separate swimming times, for example, would be harmful because it would result in government-enforced segregation. But allowing Muslim women to wear full-body burkinis in the pool could be acceptable. We can find a way to compromise without compromising our commitment to equality. And from Canada, we don't need a first lady. The wife of our prime minister is at it again, said Lauren Gunter. Sophie Gregoire Trudeau already appalled the nation with her demand for two nannies to help care for her three children at taxpayer expense, even though she doesn't have a job. Now she wants a second personal assistant as well. It seems that when she and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau visited the White House last March, the one thing she came away with was a big-time envy of Michelle Obama, who as First Lady has a staff of 22. Gregoire Trudeau is claiming that she has been overwhelmed with requests for personal appearances and endorsements. To hear her tell it, she's just so gosh dang popular and working so awfully hard to promote Canadian charities and designers that she must have a larger staff. What's next? A calligrapher to handwrite her invitations for her? Young, hip, and fashionable, the Trudeaus seem to see themselves as Canada's first couple, living a glamorous life to entertain their grateful subjects, who provide them with whatever perks they demand. Someone needs to remind them that Canada doesn't officially recognize a First Lady role in the American style. Trudeau's wife can muddle along with a single servant. That's the Canadian way. And now the last word, titled this week, From Russia with Love. RT America, the Kremlin-funded U.S. cable news network, swears it isn't taking sides in the 2016 election. But watch for a few hours, says journalist Michael Crowley, and you'll find the coverage is distinctly pro-Trump. Back when he hosted a primetime talk show on MSNBC, Ed Schultz divided the world into heroes and villains. The heroes usually included Democrats like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. The villains were mostly Republicans, and especially Donald J. Trump. When Trump obsessed over Obama's birth certificate in 2011, Schultz branded him a racist. When Trump flirted with running for president, Schultz ridiculed him. Mr. Trump, stop embarrassing yourself. Another bad guy was Russian President Vladimir Putin. Schultz delighted in ripping conservatives for what he called their love affair with the Russian leader and his ability to make Obama look weak on the world stage. They hate Obama so much they will even embrace the head of the KGB. Putin is their new hero, Schultz said in one 2013 segment. In another, he smugly reminded conservatives about Putin's nasty human rights record and the way his reckless behavior was crippling Russia. That was all before last July, when MSNBC abruptly canceled The Ed Show after a six-year run and dumped the 62-year-old prairie populist from the network. By the time Schultz resurfaced this January, he had been reincarnated in a very different journalistic form as a primetime host for RT America, the U.S. branch of the global cable network formerly known as Russia Today, funded by the Russian government. Gone is the praise for Obama and Clinton. Gone, too, are the mocking references to Putin. Schultz's 8 p.m. RT show, The News with Ed Schultz, now features Putin-friendly discussions about the failings of the U.S. policy in the Middle East and America's bloated defense budget. Even Trump is getting a new look from Schultz. In recent months, Schultz has said that Trump has tapped into an anger among working people and would easily be able to function as president. Those are strange words coming from an ex-MSNBC liberal better known for his casting Trump as a racist lout. But RT is a strange place. It styles itself as an edgy CNN or BBC, delivering unvarnished news and commentary with a mostly hip young cast. But just under the surface is a bought and paid for propaganda vehicle trying to nudge viewers toward Russia's side of the story at a time when Moscow has increasingly become an international pariah. As Trump has risen, RT has gotten much more interested in the U.S. presidential campaign. The blustery billionaire has praised Putin as a strong leader, spoken of closer ties with Moscow, and mused about whether NATO is obsolete. At the foreign policy speech Trump delivered in Washington on April 27th, the Russian ambassador to the U.S. was sitting in the front row. Tune in to Schultz and his colleagues these days, and you'll find a presidential race featuring Hillary Clinton as a malevolent warmonger, Bernie Sanders as an insurgent hero, and Donald Trump as a foreign policy savant. A network that up until now has found little to celebrate about America has finally settled on a candidate it can believe in. The Russian president's face was a faint shade of green as he gazed up at a giant image of Larry King. It was December 10th, and Vladimir Putin was the guest honor at RT's 10th anniversary dinner at Moscow's Metropole Hotel in the shadow of the Kremlin. Putin wasn't green from food poisoning. The hue came from lighting that bathed the room in the lime of the network's logo. King was opening the ceremonies by video message from Los Angeles, where the 82-year-old now hosts a diminished version of his old CNN talk show for RT, joining a roster of hosts that includes other past-their-prime U.S. celebrities like Jesse the Body Ventura, the former wrestling champ turned Minnesota governor. In his trademark suspenders, King apologized for his absence and let Putin know he'd love to interview him. The Russian leader looked visibly pleased. Sitting next to Putin was RT's 36-year-old editor-in-chief, Margarita Simonyan, a raven-haired former state TV reporter who took over RT when she was 25. She is a feisty defender of her network, often lashing out against critics, and there are many, who say RT is little more than a weapon in a Russian information war against the West. When a BuzzFeed reporter asked her in 2014 about alleged Kremlin influence, Simonyan offered a mocking reply. "We just read the latest Kremlin press releases on camera. It is much more efficient that way," she wrote. And yet, Simonyan does, in fact, keep a yellow telephone with no dial pad on her desk, which she conceded to a Time reporter last year is a secure line to the Kremlin. In his remarks at the dinner, Putin showed obvious pride in the network. "Your greatest strength in presenting information freely and independently," Putin told the crowd. "We do not control you, and we do not meddle," he added. But Putin's comments are at odds with how the network operates in practice, according to interviews with people who have worked at RT, and my own hours of monitoring the network and its website. One former RT staffer in Washington, D.C., told me that she left her job after seeing the network's Moscow-based editors instruct journalists to make their coverage hew to the Moscow-approved political line. Such concerns erupted into full view a couple of years ago when Russia marched into neighboring Ukraine to annex the Crimean Peninsula, leading a 28-year-old RT presenter named Liz Wall to quit on air, declaring, "I cannot be part of a network funded by the Russian government that whitewashes the actions of Putin." Today it's clear RT operates less as the free and independent news source Putin touted, and more as a vehicle that uses the available tools of the digital revolution to promote Russia's message. It positions itself as a scrappy dissenter. "Americans," Simonyan said, "watch RT for stories, views, and analysis they won't find in the mainstream media." RT's critics, she said, are mostly members of the U.S. political establishment, who are uncomfortable with losing their longtime monopoly on information. Next to Simonyan at the dinner, and just two seats away from Putin himself, was perhaps the most intriguing example of how Russians have gone about recruiting disaffected members of that establishment. A rugged-looking man in a tuxedo who less than 18 months earlier had been head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon's powerful in-house equivalent of the CIA. Michael Flynn, now a private citizen after a reportedly disgruntled retirement, was not there to gather intelligence. His attendance at the RT Gala, before which he gave a talk on world affairs, appeared to inaugurate a relationship with the network, presumably a paid one, though neither Flynn nor RT answered queries on the subject. Flynn now makes fairly regular appearances on RT as an analyst, during which he often argues that the U.S. and Russia should be working more closely together on issues like fighting ISIS and ending Syria's civil war. At a moment of semi-hostility between the U.S. and Russia, the presence of such an important figure at Putin's table startled current and former members of the Obama administration. It was extremely odd that he showed up in a tuxedo to the Russian government propaganda arm's party, one former Pentagon official told me. But a few other things are known about Flynn. In February, Flynn called on Hillary Clinton to end her White House bid over her use of a private email server. And Flynn has also served as an informal advisor on national security to one Donald J. Trump. On March 21st, Trump was holding a news conference in Washington when he fielded an unusual question. "You've hinted that you are open to better relations with Russia as a president," began a reporter who did not audibly identify himself. "Is that a difficult position to maintain with the media in kind of anti-Russian overdrive?" "If we can get along with Russia, that's very good," Trump said. He noted that Putin, who has called Trump an outstanding and talented personality, says very nice things about me. The short but puzzling exchange made more sense a few hours later when RT aired a segment focused entirely on Trump's answer. Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump is calling for a dramatic change in U.S. policy toward Russia, explained an RT host. Beneath him on the screen, a cryon declared, Donald Trump supports improved relations between U.S. and Russia. Trump has called Putin a strong leader and said he would probably get along with him. Putin responded in kind, adding that Trump wants to move to a deeper level of relations with Russia. How can we not welcome that? In December, when Trump called Putin's compliments a great honor, the MSNBC host Joe Scarborough asked the candidate if he had concerns about praise from a person that kills journalists and political opponents and invades countries. Trump was unfazed. He's running his country, and at least he's a leader. You know, unlike what we have in this country, he said. And when ABC's George Stephanopoulos pressed him a few days later, Trump stood firm. It's never been proven that he's killed anybody. So, you know, you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, Trump said. On the topic of Clinton, RT isn't very subtle. One recent evening, a former Pentagon official and fringe conservative named Michael Maloof told a patiently listening Schultz about Clinton's total inability to manage foreign policy. On the March 23rd edition of Crosstalk, which bills itself as RT's flagship program, the show's Moscow-based host, Peter Lavelle, claimed not to see anything positive out of American foreign policy when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Zero. The three-man panel featured one Clinton defender, Washington Democratic lawyer Richard Goodstein, but when he spoke up, Lavelle cut him off, accusing Clinton of duplicity and hypocrisy. Goodstein told me that in an interview that the segment was typical of his experience on RT. When I'm on Fox, the accusation is that Obama is a weakling and Hillary has the same weak foreign policy, he said. Then I get on RT, and it's that they're these monsters who bomb indiscriminately. It's wild. Simonian insisted to me that RT was not taking sides in the election. We do not give preferential treatment to any candidate, she said. But in hours of watching RT programming, I could find only the rarest token defense of Clinton. Critical stories about Trump, touching, for example, on the violence at his rallies, tended to be less on Trump himself than on the recurring theme that America is stumbling towards social and political anarchy. Bernie Sanders, meanwhile, is routinely hailed as a courageous insurgent. Schultz has played a key role in the Sanders boosterism, even conducting softball interviews with the Vermont Democrat for RT on the eve of the Iowa caucuses and Wisconsin's primary. If you win Iowa and New Hampshire, is that a game changer? Schultz asked. Schultz, meanwhile, seems to have turned on Clinton, whom he once called his favorite living New Yorker and whose candidacy he spoke of warmly as recently as July. Now he complains that the Democratic Party has rigged the primaries in her favor and that there has been a tremendous slant of the coverage in favor of Hillary Clinton. But the people are rejecting it right now. Why the change of heart? Upon taking the job, Schultz insisted that the Kremlin wouldn't have any sway over him. Such talk, he said, was hogwash. Absolutely ridiculous. Nobody's going to tell Ed Schultz what to say, or how to say it, or what stories to pick. Maybe so. I tried to ask Schultz those questions myself, but an interview I arranged with him through an RT publicist was abruptly canceled. 2 years ago, on a radio show he then hosted, Schultz fumed at a Republican congressman who had described Putin as acting from a position of strength against Obama. Can I ask you a question? Schultz thundered rhetorically. Whose side are you on? Good question. This was excerpted from an article that was originally published in Politico magazine. Moving to the Health and Science page, our first article, doubling the exoplanet population. If the universe suddenly seems a little more crowded, it's because NASA's Kepler Space Telescope last week confirmed the existence of 1,284 newfound planets orbiting distant stars, more than doubling the number discovered since the mission was launched in 2009. These alien worlds include roughly 550 planets that could be rocky and Earth-like, nine of which orbit in their star's Goldilocks zone, the sweet spot where the conditions would theoretically be suitable for liquid water and life. All told, Kepler has now confirmed 21 potentially habitable planets. Astronomers have yet to find a dead ringer for Earth, but after extrapolating their findings to the entire galaxy, they calculate there may be tens of billions of Earth-sized exoplanets with the right conditions to support life. The closest of these could be just 11 light years away. This gives us hope that somewhere out there, around a star much like ours, we can eventually discover another Earth, NASA's Ellen Stofan tells The Guardian. To find this new planet, Kepler monitored 150,000 stars in a single patch of sky between the constellations Lyra and Cygnus, scanning for tiny blips of starlight that would betray the presence of a passing body. Next year, NASA plans to launch a new space telescope, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS, or TESS, which will search the entire sky for Earth-like planets that may be homes to alien life. And a second Health and Science article, a Band-Aid for wrinkles. While celebrities hawk wrinkle creams and other anti-aging miracles, the real action may be at MIT and Harvard, where chemical engineers have developed something they've dubbed second skin. After 9 years of work, the researchers came up with a virtually invisible, breathable film applied like a lotion that restores the skin's elasticity. The silicon-based polymer, which is made from common chemicals deemed safe by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, effectively smooths out wrinkles and makes under-eye bags disappear, albeit temporarily. The second skin dries in only a minute, withstands washing and sweat, and falls off the skin after a few days. It can also be removed with a polymer dissolving solution. What they have done is design a clever biomaterial that recapitulates the properties of young and healthy skin, Columbia University biomedical engineer Gordana Vunjak-Nikovic, who was not involved with the research, tells the New York Times. They can use it as sort of a Band-Aid over old and aging skin and get very significant results. The film's creator suggests it can also be used to help the skin retain moisture or deliver drugs to treat eczema, dermatitis, and other skin conditions. On the Talking Points page, Sykes-Picot, the map that made the Mideast. Exactly a century ago, an Englishman and a Frenchman unrolled a map of the Middle East and drew an improbably straight line across the desert, said David Blair in the Daily Telegraph. The two diplomats, Sir Mark Sykes and François-Georges Picot, were deciding how to split up the Ottoman Empire during World War I into British and French spheres of influence. With all the breezy arrogance of a colonial official, Sykes declared, "I should like to draw a line from the E in Acre to the last K in Kirkuk," ignoring the region's explosive ethnic and religious divides. He did just that, carving out the entirely artificial nations of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. A century later, the curse of Sykes-Picot still haunts the Middle East, said Robin Wright in The New Yorker. Iraq and Syria are fractured by bitter conflicts among Sunnis, Shiites, and other sects. The Kurds, split into four countries, are still fighting for autonomy. Even the Islamic State seeks to undo the old borders, proudly claiming it's hammering the last nail in the coffin of the Sykes-Picot conspiracy. Don't blame Sykes-Picot for the Middle East mess, says Stephen Cook and Am Lahaida in Foreign Policy. The agreement was only a rough draft. And besides, today's conflicts are not really about the validity of places like Syria, Iraq, or Libya. There are no natural nations in this region, where various sects and ethnic groups live in close proximity. That reality has led to the rise of strongmen who pit competing groups against one another, like Syria's Bashar al-Assad and Iraq's Saddam Hussein. Those cynical, brutal tyrants are the real source of the region's misery. Now, though, a great sorting out is taking place in the Middle East, said John Richard Cookson in the nationalinterest.org. It's a slow-rolling ethnic cleansing like the bloody breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, as Iraq and Syria dissolve into separate Kurd, Sunni, and Shiite regions. Western powers, however, should avoid the temptation to help Iraqis and Syrians redraw the map, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. As Sykes-Picot proved, outside meddling can have unintended consequences. Breaking up existing countries might accelerate the ethnic cleansing and lead to more violence. Let's not imitate the colonial diplomats of yesteryear by sitting around our conference rooms and offices in Washington and New York, doodling on the maps of the Middle East. Trump's taxes, a ticking time bomb? What is Donald Trump trying to hide in his tax returns, asks David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. The presumptive Republican nominee insisted again this week that he cannot make those documents public because of an ongoing IRS audit of several years' worth of returns, and that the process just might continue until after the general election. Yet taxpayers are free to release returns when they're under audit. Richard Nixon did exactly that in 1973. All Republican and Democratic nominees since 1976 have released their returns, so why won't Trump? Usually so proud of his wealth, do the same. As former GOP nominee Mitt Romney said last week, the only logical explanation for Trump's intransigence is that his returns contain some form of a bombshell. The issue is definitely a ticking time bomb for the GOP, said John Fund in NationalReview.com. Trump's tax returns could contain all sorts of damaging revelations, that he gives little or no money to charity, or uses legally dubious tricks in tax shelters to pay a lower tax rate than most Americans. When asked last week by ABC's George Stephanopoulos what tax rate he pays, Trump shot back, "It's none of your business." Most damaging of all, the returns might show that Trump is nowhere near as rich and successful as he wants people to believe. Whether he releases the returns or not, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, the issue could be Trump's Achilles heel. With no experience in public office, he has centered his entire campaign on his supposed entrepreneurial genius and business acumen, skills he can magically use to solve all of America's problems. Without those skills, he's just a dumber version of Pat Buchanan. Trump's refusal to let the public see his returns suggests that he is a total fraud. Still, Trump will probably decide he's better off not releasing the returns, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Why give the Clinton campaign new ammunition? Instead, Trump will do what he always does, create distractions that push the issue to the back burner while attacking Crooked Hillary for her own ethical problems, including endangering national security with her private email server and unethically mixing State Department and Clinton Foundation business. If voters aren't put off by Trump's racist dog whistling, his thuggish behavior and his nearly constant stream of lies, his tax returns probably aren't going to be a decisive factor. And a few short notes. President Obama came into office pledging to end the wars of his predecessor, but if the U.S. remains at war in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria until the end of his term, Obama will be the only president in American history to serve two complete terms with the nation at war. Online dictionary searches for the word transgender have spiked 630% recently, according to Merriam-Webster. Emma Morano of Verbaria, Italy, 116, has become the oldest woman in the world after the deaths of Susanna Mushat Jones of New York City, who was also 116. Morano attributes her long lifespan to her decision to leave an unhappy marriage to a dominating man in 1938. She may be the last living person on Earth born in the 19th century. For the first time since 2001, the volume of alcohol consumed in the world dropped last year. The drop was largest in countries suffering big economic slumps. In China, total consumption dropped by 3.5%, and in Brazil, by 2.5%. And we'll finish with a quote from George Bernard Shaw. Life's ultimate statistic is the same for all people. One out of one dies. Well, on that happy note, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.